Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Freilich and Chanukah. You folks can move up. I think I have to stay here because I think they're recording all of this, so I have to stay at the mic, although I'd much rather get down there with you folks. I hope you can hear me, and again, if you want to move up, I haven't bitten anyone in many years. Not a topic about Chanukah, but certainly I hope a topic that fits today's framework of Judaism and other cultures, and certainly fits very important issue of Jewish identity within Jewish history, which Chanukah certainly commemorates and celebrates, right? What is your Jewish identity, and how do you make sure your Jewish identity is proper? We will look at this historically and through learning. Rav Willig just gave a tremendous talk about how to look at this conceptually and personally, and wherever you were before this, I hope these talks will come together in some way. I'd also just like to take the personal privilege. My father, Haredi Kaparis Mishkova's first Yortzeit is tomorrow night, so I'd like to dedicate today's talk L'zeichu Nishmas Avi Mori, Haredi Kaparis Mishkova, and I thank you very much for participating. Let me give you the historical context and the learning context, and we'll get right to it. And Bli Neder will be done by 12:15. We're running a little late, but I appreciate people have Chanukah parties, and perhaps even, I shouldn't say it too loudly, but football games, which I very much sympathize with. I won't tell you what kind of a fan I am, because we'll get into trouble. But in any case, we'll try to do our work in a very efficient way. The historical context for today's talk is really Ashkenaz, the Rhineland, German and Northern French Jewry in the period of the First Crusade and beyond. As I'm sure many of you know, the First Crusade in 1096 really had a tremendous impact, a little bit in Eretz Yisrael, where it was meant to be, perhaps more than a little bit, but in terms of the death and the threatening of Jewish life, the impact in the Rhineland community was very, very significant. Medieval demographics are a very slippery slope, very hard to give an exact population number and a number of those who were killed, Rahman al-Tzlan, but the number is somewhere between 5 and 10,000, which if you consider that European Jewry around the year 1100 may have had only 50,000 souls, that's a very significant hereg rav. And for that reason, of course, B'nai Ashkenaz, and I suspect Gam B'nai Sfarad V'Acherim have in their kinos, in their slichos, references to this particular event, Gezeirat Tatnu, or Gezeirot Tatnu, as it's referred to, Jewish calendar date, Tatnu, which corresponds to 1096. And of course, an awful lot has been written, I'm not here to depress you, God forbid, an awful lot has been written about what we call Ashkenazic martyrdom. The fact is that not all of those Jews who died, but many of them were killed by the Christian crusaders and even took their own lives as a way of avoiding being tortured and otherwise being forced to accept Christianity. We don't have statistics, what percent of the community, it's hard to know. See it a little bit reflected in the literature of the Tosfot, Avodah Zarah Daf Yud Ches, Rabbeinu Tam, who lived after the First Crusade, talks about why this kind of behavior is appropriate. It's a very sensitive question. I've written about it, others have written about it, and that's not our subject today. Our subject today is the fact that a number of Jews in Ashkenaz, in northern France and in Germany, northern France is not as affected by the First Crusade as the Rhineland was, but Ashkenazic Jewry at this time really consists of those two areas, those two geographic areas. There is evidence, both from the First Crusade and from the persecutions beyond in the 12th century, that there were Jews who did accept Christianity, many of them under duress. In other words, not everyone did Kiddush Hashem. And here again, there's all kinds of scholarly literature, what happens in Ashkenaz, what happens in Sfarad, in the Sephardic world, during similar types of persecution, obviously involving Islam more than Christianity. There were Jews who did accept Christianity. Many were forced, many under duress, some apparently more willingly. We're not here to judge them. God forbid, no one should have to make that choice or have that question. But the question that Balei Halacha and Rashi and Balei HaTosfot, who are the main figures that we'll talk about today, Rashi was the leader, as we might expect, But you know, we know Rashi mostly from Chumash, from Tanakh, from Gemara. Rashi seems, as he seems to really have been, as a very kind and gentle soul. Aval hu haya gadol hador. Rashi was also Rashi, and he made some very strong halachic policies in light of the fact that there were Jews who did convert. And as you see it on the sources here, and before we even get to the Hebrew source in number one, you can take a look in English in number two. Mori v'Rabbi Hamanoch v'Hadagul, my late, very great teacher, Professor Jacob Katz of the Hebrew University, but luckily we were able to have him just for me, it seems, teach here at Yeshiva a number of years ago after he retired. He was fantastically productive in his very late years. He always talked about his second career. He sort of had part one, part two, and he was here at Yeshiva during part two. Professor Katz, based on Rashi's tshuvas, Rashi wrote responsa. They're not as famous for us as his commentaries to Tanakh or to Gemara, but he wrote tshuvas, which were collected and published really in 1941 for the anniversary of his birth, 1941, by someone named Yisrael Elfenbein, and that's what you have cited here in source number one. Rashi had a refrain. How do we deal with these Jews who had either willingly or accepted Christianity at the time of the First Crusade, and nobody's judging them, the question is, what's the halacha? Or were forced to accept Christianity, how do we treat them? How do we, the Jewish community, treat them as long as they seem to be practicing Christianity? And how easy, difficult, what are the halachic positions about, and how do we treat them as they may want to come back to the Jewish community? And according to Professor Katz's analysis, Rashi, and it's very clear that he's absolutely right about this, Rashi took a phrase and a concept in the Gemara, it's in Yevamos, it's in Sanhedrin, it's in other places, and he really made it what we could call a leitmotif. He made it his policy. And the policy boils down to, it's based really on a pasuk, Yisrael afal pi shechata Yisrael, who simply put, what we might say, a Jew is a Jew is a Jew. Literally, a Jew, even though he has sinned, Yisrael afal pi shechata, sinned very grievously, right? Acceptance of Christianity is a very great sin for a Jew, especially if it's willing. Yisrael hu. Bleibt ohne Yid, that's old French, right? He remains a Jew. And Rashi actualized that position. This wasn't just rhetoric. It wasn't just a drasha. It wasn't just a good vort. Rashi actualized this position in his tshuvas time after time. And there are several tshuvas about this. In two distinct ways. Number one, that means that as long as a Jew, a born Jew, a full Jew, is associated with the Christian community, even though other Jews should not and may not eat with him, pito v'yeno asurim, his food is considered not kosher, another Jew may not partake of his food, except for that, he is to be treated completely as a Jew. And so, for example, if this is a period in the Middle Ages where Jews are already involved in money lending, they are not, as the Shylock legend suggests, the only money lenders, the exclusive money lenders. Not all Jews are money lenders. Rashi doesn't seem to have been a money lender. That's not the point. They may not, however, lend to this Mishumad, and here are the terms that we need, a mishumad, an apostate, someone who is currently separated from the Jewish community and seems to be practicing Christianity, or at least going along. They may not lend money to him at interest. He's a Jew. If they lend money to him, it must be as to any other Jew. No interest. Similarly, they may not borrow from him at interest. In other words, a yid bleibt a yid in this respect. And so whether it's money lending, whether it's matters of inheritance, and you can imagine all the questions that arose, as long as this Jew is within the Christian community, afa pi shechata Yisrael hu, he's to be treated fully, to be considered fully as a Jew, you don't eat his food. There's got to be some limitation. You don't fraternize with him in that way. You can certainly speak with him. You can certainly, to the contrary, but the only limitation comes in that very personal regard. Why did Rashi hold that way? A, because he thought that was the halacha, but he also thought quite clearly and quite helpfully and properly that the halacha was such because we'd like lachziro lemutav. We'd like to have that Jew, so to speak, back in the fold. And therefore, by treating him as a Jew, that preserves his Jewish identity, and by not making any distinction except this one personal intercourse and personal interaction, which makes very good sense, the chances of bringing him back were that much greater. And that leads to the second part of Shitas Rashi, which is just 1A and 1B. If a Jew who had accepted Christianity, again, whether under force or willingly, lo mishaneh, no difference, if such a Jew wanted to come back, he now presents himself to the community and says, I'm back. I hope he doesn't say, I'm back. Right? I'm back. I'm here. I want back in. What hoops must he jump through in order to be back? According to Rashi, the answer is? Very good. A rousing none is correct. Zero. You come back. You go to the shul. And we'll see just how quickly Rashi let the food be eaten. You'll see, it's an immediate turnaround again, because that's really Rashi's megama here. Afa pishachati Yisrael hu, bring him back. Don't put him in a twilight zone. Don't wait to see what happens. You'll say, well, let's see how he does. We'll see what happens. 6 month probation. No probation, no big buildup. Bring a Jew, such a Jew, right back. And that you can see, in source number two in English, Professor Katz's statements about Rashi's position, and you can see just the beginning of the second frame that later Rishone Ashkenaz, he mentions here Rabbi Eliezer ben Yoel, the Ravia, the Riva, these are great German Rishonim, they accepted Rashi's position too. According to Professor Katz, this is how Ashkenazic rabbinic authorities dealt with this problem throughout the medieval period. If you look in source number one, and here it's from Professor Grossman's very wonderful book that's just been translated into English, but it wasn't time for me to get you the English phrases, and we can read Mekoros here. This is Kol Yom Rishon, Mutar Lekrobi Mekorot. If you take a look, Professor Grossman summarizes Rashi's position in the lines before and the lines after, but if you look at the middle frame, Al Ha'anusim, doesn't mean Spanish Moranos, this means Rashi's period. Ashkenazic Jews, im yesh lefrosh min yeinan ad sheyamdu b'tshuvatan yamim rabim. A Jew has come back. A Jew who was practicing Christianity. Anusim means they were forced into it. But we'll see, Rashi really makes no distinction. The question asked of him, we have these Jews who were forced into conversion at the time of the Crusade, and because of that, we could not drink their wine. The food is a half a problem, right? Kosher food you can probably get. But the wine that they're serving, right? Christian wine, stam yenam, that's a particularly sensitive issue. If they've come back, should we wait? Ad she'amdu b'tshuvatan yamim rabim. Should we wait and see? We shouldn't associate with them in this way and eat with them until it's been a while since they've done this tshuva. Let's see if it takes. Right? And v'tiyeh ha-tshuva shalahem mifursemet ugluya, such that their repentance will be obvious and clear. Let's give it a cooling off period. Let's see how we do. Let's see how they do. V'heishiv Rebbe, which is Rebbe or Rashi, and again, the authenticity of this tshuva Rashi is without question, shechalila lifrosh min yeinan levayshan. Once they say they're back, and once they invite you to Kiddush, eat. Why? Ki lo mil'u linaseich af la'avod hazara. And here Rashi is really talking about even those Jews who converted willingly. Even if they willingly took part in church ritual, their intention was not to create idolatrous yayin nesach. Yes, sir. We'll have to talk about the question, which I'll take. This interaction I like, and it's very on the point. I'll take on point questions happily and gladly. He's been here before. His question was, but Rashi holds that Christianity was not Avodah Zarah. We can discuss why you think that. I'm not so sure. Right? Rashi, again, there's a distinction here certainly not from this text, but in other texts too, there may be a distinction between Christians and Christianity. We have to talk about that, and that's the business with Tosfos speaking of Avodah Zarah. You may be right, but I'm not sure. Not because you didn't ask it well, you asked it very well. Leave that aside for the moment. But Rashi makes the path here very easy. It's a very fair question. So first of all, if they converted even willingly, they didn't mean to be real over the Avodah Zarah, whether for your reason or for another reason, number one. Number two, once they've accepted to come back, and this in some ways is even more interesting, what does it take for a Jew to come back? Show back up to the community. Now, some of this has to do with the medieval context. And again, even though we don't have time to discuss it today at any length, Professor Katz held that this type of approach in Ashkenaz obtained throughout the Middle Ages, and we're going to see in a moment that it doesn't quite seem to be so, but we'll see why, and only in the modern period, in the early modern period, when Ashkenazic Jewry really moved to Eastern Europe, that didn't happen in a day either, do we have a different policy. And the reason for that, in part, has to do with the nature of the medieval Jewish community and the early modern Jewish community. In the medieval Jewish community in Europe, if you weren't part of the Jewish community, you were part of the Christian community. And if you weren't part of it, you might be some little Islamic communities and so on. There were no streams of Judaism. So you were either part of the Jewish community, which was Torah observant, or you were flirting with another religion. There was very little of a, you know, demilitarized zone, very little bit of a gray zone in between. Halanu ata im litzareinu. You had to have a religious affiliation, so either it was A or it was B. If you left Christianity to come back to Judaism, there weren't six places to stop off, if you follow my drift, on the way. Either you're in or you're out. Once the early modern period rolls around, part of modernity says not just the different types or streams or approaches to Judaism, which become very important in the modern period, but there are within modern society, simply put, more places religiously to hide. And therefore, Professor Katz says, if you look at Ashkenazic decisors, and he's absolutely right about this, in the early modern period, in 16th century Eastern Europe, and you actually have them listed at the bottom of the sheet, I'll refer to them in a couple of minutes anyway, Chachamim like the Ramah, Reb Moshe Isserles, who dies in 1573, the Marashal, Reb Shlomo Luria, who dies in 1572, right? Several hundred years, 400 years after the First Crusade, right? More. The Bach, the Shach, in 17th century Eastern Europe, they will all require what I call the Mishumat HaChozer B'Tshuvah. That was my title, the penitent apostate. It's a tongue twister. The Mishumat who wants to come back, they all required him to go through immediately, automatically, more hoops, including some of the things we're going to talk about today. And says Professor Katz, who both was a lamdan in terms of the sources and a great historian, the way to understand that and explain that is there are more gaps between the two societies. But Biyamav Shal Rashi, and following, again, as we already saw him citing, 12th century Balei HaTosfos, Rashi's successors in learning, his family, his successors, 13th century Chachmei Ashkenaz, everybody buys this same position for the reasons indicated. Now, if you look at the end of the English piece in number two, you will see that Professor Katz, who also, it's wonderful to learn with him, a Lamdin, a great historian, who was rigorous and very intellectually honest, never fudged. It's good to be that way as a historian, I would say. Professor Katz said, I do find a couple of mikorot from Ashkenaz in the 13th century, maybe even the 12th, which had the community, and that's what we're going to talk about now, putting the repentant apostate, the Mishumad HaChozer B'Tshuvah, for example, into the mikvah. You got to go to the mikvah. Now you'll tell me that's not very painful. Nobody thought that a male, and by the way, this applies to women as well, nobody thought that a male repentant apostate had to redo the bris milah, Baruch Hashem, right? So it's not painful here. But it's still a very big act. Telling a born Jew to go to the mikvah in order to come back to the Jewish community, that's a very big statement. Now, Rashi himself does not take an explicit position on this, but as Professor Katz indicates, min hastam, we would imagine, without any other evidence, that this flies in the face of Rashi's approach. Because the mikveh is not just a little dip in the water, it's a very momentous act, and it's a very significant act. Because a non-born Jew, a born Christian, or born anything else, who wants to be a Jew, must go to the mikveh as part of the gerus. That's not the only part, must go to the mikveh. So if you find some evidence that mishumodim hachozrim b'tshuva, these repentant apostates, must go to the mikveh, that ostensibly is not what Rashi would prefer, and again flies in the face of this very, I don't mean gentle in the silly sense, but in the halachic sense, generous and gentle and encouraging position that Rashi had developed. So being honest, Professor Katz says, I found a couple of examples in the 13th century, but he says, very cogently, these were popular practices. In other words, who made these mishumadim go to the mikveh? Not the rabbonim, so to speak, not the halacha, but the kehilos, the Jews. In other words, you want to be back in the club, you know, I don't know if it's worse or better than shul membership, but you want to be in the club, joking, you've got to do something. So we're not going to make you stand in the cold, you know, with a t-shirt on for 3 weeks. That's not right. But we are going to do something substantive. We're going to make you go to the mikveh. So Professor Katz says, Nachon, there are a few such sources, and he has reasons to explain that they're all sort of popular approaches. Right? In fact, one of them, which again, we won't have much time now, but this is in English, so you can read it too, is a very interesting tshuva of Maharam Rutenberg, who died in 1293, the very end of the period of the Baliat Tosfos. This is translated in Professor Agus's edition. He taught, he was my teacher here for a number of years as well. And he's got a very unusual case, which I'll just mention quickly. It's really, and I've only given you two disconnected snippets. There was a case of a Jew who was missing. And the problem was, what does his wife do now? And there were two sets of sort of witnesses or people who wanted to testify. One set was a group of non-Jews, highwaymen, thieves, who said, and he left home to do business, and you know, claim was he went from France to Germany, he somehow got someplace, and then goes missing. These highwaymen said, we saw him Nebuchadnezzar's grave, he's dead. Three of them, and they're just reporting, misichim lefi tumam. On the other side is a Jew who had been a mishumit, who had been an apostate, who had accepted Christianity. And he says, no, he never left the home area, he's alive. And the Maharami Rutenberg goes so far as to say, the problem with the highwaymen, by the way, is, in unrelated or perhaps related events, they had given their testimony, they were then put to death for their crimes. So you have three dead non-Jewish highwaymen against one live Jew who had been an apostate, right? And that's quite a, you know. Maharam says, we go with the evidence that was extracted properly of the dead highwaymen, because an apostate's evidence in this case, this he's not currently apostate, but this fellow was apparently, you'll see it in the text here, what I like to call a flip-flopper. He was a serial converter. He was a Jew, sometimes he was a Christian, he went back, and Maharami Rutenberg describes his insincerity as tovlim v'sheretz bi'adam. They go to the mikveh while holding, you'll forgive me, a rodent. Doesn't work. The most tummy thing in the world. Now, this might simply be his way of saying he was insincere. Professor Katz suggests that what Maharam is saying is, don't tell me, but he went to mikveh. He had his fingers crossed. That's my phrase. It's a bad phrase, just for a joke, right? He was faking it. And the other phrase is you see that I've given you in the Hebrew, shav v'lo b'chol kocho tshuva shel rimiya. It was insincere conversion. So again, says Professor Katz, was there a mikveh involved with this returning apostates with us? Apparently there was. He was violating the rules. So we see a few sources which seem to mention obliquely mikveh. That would suggest that Rashi's position was not upheld. Professor Katz's solution very cleverly, and I think with much on it in its favor is that this was a popular series of tevilah. Interesting. Do you have communities that sometimes want to be frummer than in their leaders? Sometimes. But this is not simply a matter of frumkeit. It's a matter of membership. The rank and file wanted to show the meshumid, hey, we're happy you're back. We're not making you swing from the chandeliers, God forbid. And you have to come back to the community. But do us and you a favor. Get in there. That's how they told the males. The women, they were more polite to. But anyway, yeah, please. Right, so that if you remain in that state, you can't associate. So it was a very fine line. Again, even Rashi is not saying, forget that he's an apostate, you know, count him in the minyan. Chas v'shalom. You've got to stay away from him on a personal interaction level. But as far as his coming back to Judaism, once he's made that decision and has come back to the community, that restriction is lifted immediately. And I don't think the issue is, does he have any wine in his cellar, you know, in his wine vat? I don't think that's the technical issue. I think the issue is, do we have this period, this probation period? And Rashi's approach was, absolutely not. And again, according to Professor Katz, that seems to have won the day. So now we come in source number four to an interesting source. It's a Christian source. It's a very unusual source. It was published in 1970 with English translation by Professor Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, Alav HaShalom, who actually did his BA at Yeshiva College. I won't say what happened to him afterwards, except that he got a doctorate at Columbia. He taught for many years at Columbia, at Harvard, a very great scholar. And Professor Yerushalmi in 1970 published a very long article in the Harvard Theological Review, and that's what you have in front of you, a little snippet of the confessor's manual of someone named Bernard Guy. Bernard Guy was a Christian, a Dominican confessor. His job was to find out about people, Christians, who had lapsed in their Christianity, and obviously there were punishments involved, and he was very good at getting confessions out of people. What did you do? What did this one do wrong? What did somebody else do wrong? In any event, to make a long story short, one of the vignettes, one of the pieces that Professor Yerushalmi found in this Latin manual that came out around 1320, was dated 1320, and apparently involves Jews. Bernard Guy was in southern France, but apparently involves Jews who had lived in Germany, Jews who were connected to Germany. Apparently what happened here is Jews had converted to Christianity. These are the Jews he was speaking to. And they then went back to the Jewish community. So he wanted to know from them, you can imagine why, well, what did they make you do? You know, what was the re-entry rite? And they describe here in the quoted piece a very involved procedure where the returner, the returnee, the Meshumet HaChozer, the Jewish community, according to these witnesses, told Bernard they would make him go into the mikveh. But before that, this is what you would call the mikveh men from Mars. They would rub his skin energetically with sand and soap, especially the areas that had accepted the chrism, what's called the baptismal center points, right? They would cut his nails till they bled. You know, this was just shave off his hair. I mean, they really not just put him in the mikveh, they put him in the mikveh with, you know, gusto. What's that? So some of this is chatzitza issues, right? But fingernails till they bleed is, yeah, that's pretty. And the rubbing energetically the sand on the chrism, right? There's no physical, the chrism is oil that by now had been washed off, you know, 15 years before or 3 hours before. So the hislavus, you're right, there is a chatzitza issue. But two things. The hislavus is interesting. But what's even more interesting is, what does this text say? This text says that returning apostates were being sent to the mikveh for sure. Somewhere in the late 13th century, very early 14th century. This certainly flies, and by the way, and it seems to be a basin that's doing this. In other words, it's an organized group. This is not just some balabatim out of control, you'll forgive me. Right? It seems to be an official kind of rite. There's a bracha involved. I mean, this is very formal. So how does this jibe with Professor Katz's theory? Rashi, Afapi Shechatai Yisrael, bring him back. So Professor Yerushalmi, being very smart in 1970, said, I searched through all the medieval codes. I didn't find any evidence for this in the medieval halachic works, but I did find evidence in that list of 16th and 17th century authorities in Eastern Europe. Right? And he quotes this whole list of the Ramah, the Marshal, the Bach, and the Shach. And he says, must be that even though this looks very formal, it was something popular. You know, in other words, he basically quotes Professor Kass and says, you know what, despite the energy and despite the formality and despite the ceremony and despite all of this, it's not only not required by halacha, not really the Rabbanim necessarily, it's the mikveh committee, it's the Mishum Adam committee. Right? And that's how he leaves it. Yes. Always bring knowledgeable people to the lectures. Very good. We didn't really cook this up, but he's been here before, as I said. Again, the dating here is early 14th century, so 1320, way before anybody going to Amsterdam, way before all of that. You'd be right, except this is more than 160 years before, so we can't get out of it that way, but it's a good try. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. We could, if you want. All right, because all right. You'll hold your question? Okay. He's a nice young man. Hold this question. Okay, good. We'll work it out together. It's Hanukkah. We all know how we light the candles. We're okay. If you look at source number 5, just rotate. That's in case you were falling asleep. Now you have to rotate so you'll wake up. So now, in the time that I have left, I will show you several manuscript passages, which Mori Rabbi Professor Katz didn't have, because we barely knew of the existence of these manuscripts when he was yet alive, that seemed to tell a different story. And I will suggest that, in fact, the analysis of Rashi's position is absolutely correct. The fact that many Rabbanim, Balei HaTosfos, held this way is absolutely correct. But I will show you that, at least with respect to mikveh, there was, in fact, a group of Balei HaTosfos, both in Germany and in northern France in the 12th and 13th centuries, who did seem to, on some level, and the question is what level, and you can help me with that, required tevila. In other words, not that, God forbid, Rashi loses, but there is a second halachic position that is more stringent in this regard. And I'll just tell you at the very end that this has legs in a couple of other areas too. So in other words, nothing that Professor Katz said is incorrect, but there is a second side to this that emerges almost exclusively from manuscript. The one or two texts that might have been printed in his day, in fact, I don't think he saw. But that's, I'm just being so deferential, because he was terrific at responding to people who questioned his theories in a very good way, and I didn't have the chance to tell it to him when he was still alive. So I'm just trying to think, what would he have said? And the answer, I think, would have been, these are manuscript passages, some very interesting ones, but they tell a different story. This first one looks like a manuscript. It's really my computer, but it was an old computer, so it looks a little messy. Just let's read the first part together for a minute. Ma'aseh b'mishumad, and you have some of the biography in my English scroll at the top. Ma'aseh b'mishumad echad sheba b'tchua. There was a mishumad, someone who had accepted Christianity, who appeared in Troyes or Troy. This is Rashi's hometown, in the northeastern Champagne district of France. V'shalu lo bet Yehudim imasa tshuva. And two Yidin, you know, as with today, hello, how are you? Did you do tshuva? Are you sincere? He had come back. Okay, fair question. I hope they asked it politely. V'amar hein. And he said, yep, yes, I did. Answer the affirmative. V'nichnas beveit, this is Sierra Leone. He went to a family. He went to apparently an important family, va'asa atzmo shamash, and he became a waiter. He became a servant or a waiter. V'hotzi mikol hayenot, and in this capacity, so let's get the scene: a Jew who had accepted Christianity comes back to the Jewish community. A yid mivat machan aleben. He has to make a living. He becomes a waiter or a servant. And he pours, and the question is, has he come back fully and properly? He says yes, but that's his word. And now, in his job, he pours all kinds of Jewish wine. Vinishal L'Ri. Ri is Rashi's great-grandson, as you have in the top, Yitzchak ben Shmuel of Dom Pierre, not far from Troyes. Al Hayenot. He was asked, this is a question now, Ri of Dompira dies in 1189, so this is later in the 12th century, what do we do with the wine that he's been pouring? Maybe he didn't come back fully, and again, the wine should then be off bounds for Jews, right? That much we should do. And he says, v'hichshir, kosher, no problem. But he'll say, oh yeah, because he sincerely came back. And he says, de lo dami la'am ha'aretz tzarich gimel anashim. If an Am Haaretz, in terms of Tumah v'Tahara, this goes back to Beit HaMikdash times, little Chanuk and beyond, right? Taharat HaShemen. If an Am Haaretz wants to become a Chaver, a Jew who wants to upgrade his status in terms of knowledge and care for Tumah v'Tahara, has to present himself before a Beit Din. You can't declare yourself a legend in your own mind. You've got to be verified as someone who can make this spiritual jump. So if that person needs a tribunal of three to interview him, you know, this fellow at most talked to two people. You know, in other words, he never went through this process. Ree says it doesn't matter. And read the underline here, folks. This is the money quote. Aval hay mishumid yodeahu shekol zman she'eino tovel u'mekabel alav divrei chachamim u'muchzak k'goy. The reason we accept his word is because he knows, I'll use a, you know, darn well, very well, that as long as he has not gone to the mikveh and fully accepted, re-accepted rabbinic authority, we're going to treat him like not a Jew, right? A guy, right? And he says, he goes further and he says, Lekach lo tzarich gimel, he doesn't need a full Beit Din, a tribunal to verify. We can tell that if he's returned or not. Why? We just have to look. If he's coming to shul, again, there may not even be two shuls, but there are certainly not three in a town, right? And there aren't different streams and what kind of orthodox are you? Centrist, left, right, top, bottom, not orthodox. There isn't any of that. He's in shul, I don't mean that derisively, he's in shul, he's davening, he's giving tzedakah, he's doing what he's supposed to be doing. That, coupled with the tevila, the immersion, that tells us he's okay. I'm going to hold the question for a minute, but what does that mean, though, about the tevila? First of all, Ri of Dompira is recognizing that the fellow should go to the mikveh. What kind of a requirement is it? It's certainly not min haTorah. It's a rabbinic requirement. And what is its role? It almost sounds like, what? A deterrent. He knows, you know, kind of an indicator. He knows that we know that he knows that we know that if he didn't go to the mikveh, oh boy, he's in trouble. Now, do we trust him to go to the mikveh? We do. Do we trust women to go to the mikveh when they're supposed to go? And that can be minat Torah, right? And the answer is yes. Eid echod nemon bisurim. But we expect that he will do that, just as we expect that he will accept rabbinic authority. And we assume that if it walks like a frum Jew and quacks like a frum Jew, must now be a committed Jew, a no longer Christian in any level in terms of his practice or his mindset. Yes? So what this text then means is Rashi's great grandson, the Ri, is saying, I approve of this type of tefillah. Now, did it start from the Balabatim and the Ri accepted it? Efshar. In other words, was this a minig Yisroel that the Ri said, you know what? Good idea? Very possible. But the bottom line is the Ri and the Ri Midampira, you know, take my word for it, is Rashi's great-grandson, one of the greatest of the Balei HaTosfot. In the late 12th century, there is no one bigger than he. So apparently a counterposition has developed. Fast question, go.
I would disagree.
Go ahead.
Interpretation.
Go.
This is clearly not the position of the Balei HaTosfot to have a feeling of presence of that is, because that would have called
Right. All right. So I'm gonna. I got it. By the way, I agree with you 100%. Good comment. This is a middle position, but it certainly is way past Rashi's position. That's my only point. In other words, you raise another important point here, which we should say in any case. Whatever we talk about today, don't try this at home. There are achronim about all of this. You even have Reb David Tzvi Hoffman and Lamed Lahoel. You have all kinds of later sources. The point that I'm making, though, is that Professor Katz's notion of this monolithic Rashi position holding sway, there's a crack in the wall, and it's not a little crack, it's a big crack. It is not yet a requirement of, you know, a quasi-gerus, but I will show you a couple other things in a second. But you're right. Right. So good. So agreed. What type of a tevila is this? We don't talk about quasis in halacha. This is a quasi. Fill in the gap after the quasi. Let me give you just a couple other sources on the back, because our time is almost out, and I'll show you that all of a sudden, pun partly intended, because it's not bad, a floodgate of such opinions is released. Once we turn the corner on the year 1200, I can show you tevila after tevila. Look, for example, in source number 6, and this is really tevila with an attitude. If you look at the Avi HaEzri, and where these sources are coming from now, because of time, you'll play along with me for a moment, because I'll verify them for you, but I won't go through all the bibliography. Avi HaEzri Pasak. The Avi HaEzri is the Ravia, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yoel HaLevi, dies around 1225, mostly in Cologne in Germany. Avi HaEzri Pasak, Yisrael Kishanishtameid, a Jew who apostatized, that's how you conjugate that word, Kishiyashuv, when he comes back to the community, Tzarich Lehaavir Aroshot Ta'ar. He's got to do, I heard Rabbi Willick talking about TV in his day, Shem Tzichnit, he's got to do a Kojak, right? He's got to shave off all his hair. The younger people looking at me like I've lost my mind. Vilasot Tevila Kager. And to do a dunk in the mikvah like a ger, the k is important. Elz nishta ger, he's not a convert, but like a ger. The ein sarich shitehe tvilato bayom, but a ger who does his immersion at night may have to do over because it's a maaseh beit din. Here it's not. So the ravia is bumping this thing up a little bit. He's not a ger, but he's like a ger. You've got to shave completely, right? Again, is that a chatzitza problem? Or is that starting to tell us what Bernard Guy is getting at? In other words, this was a ceremony, right? Shaving your hair for the mikveh, right? Most people go to the mikveh, especially the women, thank God, don't have to shave their hair. This fellow does. So there's a maisa. Again, it doesn't hurt. But does it mean like he's like a metzora? He's coming back to the machaneh? It could mean a lot of things, right? The metzora has to have a complete shave. Right? Sorry. So this is an interesting problem. Aval hatvilat zarich liot lifnei gimel bnei adam. But his tevila has to have people witnessing it. So it's at night. It's not exactly a gerus, but there are witnesses, right? I'm sorry. Pardon me. Not the tevila. Aval hakabbalah. He has to meet with a board. He has to re-accept Judaism. So the Avi HaEzri is bumping this up. There's certainly a dunking. That can be private, that can be at night, but there's got to be a formal statement during the day. And as I mentioned here in my scroll, this is quoted by two other Northern French, one and one German source later in the 13th century. Now I stress, if you look at the end of number 6, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak ben Avraham, this is Ritzbah of Don Pira, Re's successor in Don Pierre. He seems to think that the tevila is not required. Mishumar hashav b'tshuva, kedin shelo haya tzarich gimel lekabel b'fnehem, debekal yesh lomar sheshav el boro, va'afilu divrei hamachmirim, mikom akom eino yei nesech, right? Kevan shenoheg b'yahadut, va'afilu lo taval. Whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, the tevila for this ritzbah, even the immersion part, is not required really. This is Rashi's position. Again, But my point is here, by the late 12th, early 13th century, you've got a pretty interesting machloket. Let me give you two more quick examples. If you rotate back around again, number 7 may be another version of Tshuvat Ari. I put this one on because I just found it a couple of weeks ago, so I'm happy about it. These are all manuscripts, folks. National Library in Israel has them all on film. If you want to make a nice trip, I'll tell you where to go. But anyway, some of them actually you can probably see here in New York on film too. But in any case, source number 8. This is the one published source, or one of two, that has this as well. The collection of responsa and rabbinic rulings. It's a case about a Jewess, Yehudit Shenit Ma'a Bein Hagoyim. Literally, she sunk in amongst the Goyim. Means she fell into the non-Jewish community. Again, willingly, unwillingly, doesn't really matter. And she had 2 children, and now she comes back. So the halacha here is that she and the children must undergo a tevilah. And not after the children are boys. Not after the boys are circumcised, because that would be what? Like a gerus. When does the ger have his immersion? Only after the circumcision if he's a male. Dafka not. Dafka before. Why? Because this is a kind of, according to this source, it's a kind of a purification process. Lefi psak ha-geonim ha-omer di Yisrael v'chotehu. Because there was a foul committed. We accept them back easily. She does nothing else, this woman, the mother. But there was a foul. The tovel beino levein atzmo. Again, privately can be this immersion. The katav harav rav bonfant. There should be an open parenthesis. That's someone named Rav Shmuel Halevi of Worms. The same sar. That's his Rebbe, Rav Simcha Mishpira, who's the most famous German Baal HaTosfot that you don't know. I know him a little bit because he doesn't appear in printed Tosfot. He's a tremendous Tosafist in Germany, exactly the time of Ravion, the first part of the 13th century. Kedei shetitaher min ha'aveira. That the immersion is not so much a deterrent. What is it? A tahara. If you lived amongst non-Jews, you go to mikveh. Not mida oraisa because you've been converted out of the faith, but because you've lived, I don't mean an impure life in the sense of immoral, you've lived bitumat hagoyim. And as the longer text says, you've eaten their food, and they're not talking, by the way, about any sexual encounters that this woman may have had. They leave that out. You've eaten their food. Now, non-Jewish food, even non-kosher food, does not make a human being tameh. It does make a Jew violate a prohibition if they've eaten it. Doesn't make it tameh. So this is not a technical tumah v'tahara. You were tameh, now you have to be tahar. This is a spiritual issue of tumah. This is taharat habal tshuva. And by the way, from here, the minig Yisrael of men, women to go to the mikveh, Erev Rosh Hashanah, Erev Yom Kippur, comes from this too. It's tevila l'shem taharat aveira. If you flip now, and I'm going to conclude, to number 9 at the top. Number 9 at the top is a very interesting text. It's a text of Rabbi Elazar of Worms, one of the Hasidei Ashkenaz, who also writes comments to Tosfot, who also writes Sifrei Halacha, who also writes Perushim on Tanakh, some of which we don't even know yet. Some are still in manuscript, and a lot of other stuff too. He's got a case here, and even though Hasidei Ashkenaz, the German pietists, are famous for acquiring all kinds of penitentials, somebody who's kafar b'ikar, somebody who's denied Judaism, relatively speaking, doesn't have to do all that much. Of course, kedarkam. He shouldn't bathe for a while or wash one's hair for a while. This is the medieval milieu, so they don't have the same hygiene that we do. Somebody once said the Middle Ages were not a very good smelling place, and they're right, but everybody, I guess, was used to it. In any case, he also advises very sagaciously that this person must stay away from churches and clergymen who got him to go over the line in the first place. And then he says, when all that's over, tovel. So in the short while that we've had, and I'm going to give you the final punchline text and explain it in 1.5 seconds, and I haven't given you all those who support Rashi, but the score, contrary to Professor Katz's approach, is Rashi and his followers, a very bona fide position. But if I had a blackboard, I'd show you there's now a second position that at least immersion is required, if not shaving and all the rest. And by the way, there are a couple of other German texts which talk about paring the nails and cutting the hair. Bernard Guy's Jews were not imagining what they were imagining, right? It was real. You've got a very distinguished litany of French and German Tosafists. Again, for those of you who like these roll calls, the Rei of Dompierre, a biggie, the Ravia in Germany, a biggie, Rab Simcha Mishpira, a biggie, and so on, Rav Elazar of Worms. Finally, if you look at source number 10, we'll bring it all home. This is a piece in the same manuscript, but in a different place, that yielded the Rei's first comment. I can't take you through all of it now, but this text is called Tosfot Shita, which puts it in the mid-13th century, either in a place called Evreux or possibly early Tosfot Rabbeinu Peretz. It's France. And this text sort of seeks to halachize what we've seen. And it gets a sugya, because what you notice about all of this, what is the nature of this immersion? Derabbanan. What Gemara is it based on? It's a rabbinic, almost a takana. This text finds a Gemara to hang this thing on. It's not a simple Gemara, but it's a Gemara. The halacha is that when an Eved Kenani, a non-Jewish servant, comes into a Jewish household, I'm not talking about now, think about the Torah, that Eved Kenani, if he's a male, is given a bris milah and is immersed to be sort of a, well, I won't call him a half a Jew, but a quasi-Jew, and is chayev and mitzvos ki'isha and so on, and certainly is true for a woman in that position. The question is, when an Eved Kenani becomes free, and that's not so simple, but if for whatever reason the Eved Kenani becomes free, what do they need at that point? So if it's a male, again, they don't need to be recircumcised. The first one did enough. But the Gemara in Yevamos in one place says they need to go to the mikvah on the way out. The Rambam and others consider that a chi of daraisa. That's a special din in Eved Kenani. Most Rishonim do not. Most Rishonim consider it a chi of derabbanan. What is the nature of that derabbanan? So this text calls it a kind of change of status heker. If I go from being an Eved Kenani to being a full Jew, I don't just waltz into that. I've got to make a statement, al pi halacha, and mikveh fits the bill very nicely. It's a sign of change. Mikveh is a very good change indicator. Says this text, the hachanami Yisrael mishumod, afal pi shechotu Yisrael hu. Again, Rashi's basic principle of a Jew is a Jew is a Jew underlies all of this, even the side that requires immersion. That point Katz is absolutely right about. They're Jews. But even though we say that, afilu hachi kisheshav tzarich tevila, this is akin to the second tevila of the Eved Kenani. If you've become a Christian and you go back to the Jewish community, davar zet tzarich, as he calls it, hekera. We have to at least note it. We don't formally reconvert you. We may not have to call a Beis Din at all. We don't necessarily have to shave everything, as some of the other Rishonim had said. But this gives it a Talmudic base. That is, again, midirabbanan. But that is very significant. So the final question, folks, is why is this happening? And again, if you plot the names that I've given you, you'll see all of a sudden the last part of the 12th century going into the 13th century and beyond, Rashi's monopoly doesn't crumble, but it gets a partner. Why? There may be something in halacha, but that's not so easy to see because we're dealing with this kind of almost quasi-halacha, certainly until this last text. And I would suggest very humbly that a little quick datum of medieval history will help us. Between the years 1171 and 1196, exactly when this thing is changing, someone named Ephraim of Bonn, a Talmud Chacham, associated with Balei HaTosfos, writes in his memoir, not his memoirs, but Sefer Zichira, Book of Memories, that there are no fewer than 11 anti-Jewish acts in the Rhineland and in northern France. Now, the loss of life, you know, one loss of Jewish life is too many, but the loss of life in its scope does not compare to the First Crusade. There we're talking about thousands, here we're talking about much smaller numbers. However, it's happening again in Germany in the same place 100 years later. That causes people to once again sit up and take notice. It means that the Jews and the Christians are having renewed difficulties. In 1171, in this same text, in Blois, in northern France, 30 Jews are put to death at the burn of the stake because of a false ritual murder charge. That, for northern French Jewry, is almost their Waterloo. It's their first crusade. It's a shock. It's a shock, and it's a shock that has to be thought about. In addition, so that's right at the time that this halakhic position changed, that we start to get people saying, Rashi is right, a Jew is a Jew is a Jew, but there needs to be some type of act for whatever purpose, as some type of deterrent for tshuva, like the Eved. Something has to happen. It's got to happen. One more little piece. Already in the 12th century, someone named Rupert of Deutz, which is near Cologne in the Rhineland, followed by a very famous figure that some of you may have heard of, Petrus Venabilis, Peter the Venerable, the Abbot of Cluny, very important French monastery. Peter says, he dies in 1156, so it's just before this period, the Jews are now the arch enemies of Christianity, period. That is a new and chilling statement. Not that before everybody was kissing cousins, but that is a new and very significant statement. And so I would like to leave open the possibility that just as Rashi showed, obviously halacha comes first. They're not just great Rishonim, they're great rabbinic leaders too. Just as Rashi, Mayafe Davar Be'ito, that was the right position, I don't mean because I think so, but that was the appropriate position to take Mitzad HaRabbanim at the First Crusade, to let Jews come back. Once you start to get these types of violent outbreaks again and again and again, it's the volume, not the numbers, that are scary here in the same places. Lo hosifu lekach, the Christians have not learned. And once you get these very strong statements about the enemy position of the Jews, what the Rabbanim are saying is, not so much they're trying to get involved in theology here per se, but what they're saying is, if you've gone over to the other side as a Meshumid and you're helping our arch enemies, we can't just let you back in with the hearts of Yasher Koach and a handshake and give you an aliyah. We've got to have something where you know that we know that you know that we know that we mean business here. We've got to keep the Jewish community safe, and we've got to keep the Jewish community protected. If that theory is right, we have a very interesting piece of Jewish leadership here, Al Pi Halacha, Gedolei Torah, Gedolei Yisrael. Quite correctly, as was stated before, this doesn't change into a much more formal way until the period of the Achronim, as we mentioned, because of the difference between Christian and Jewish society. But I think that that may be the result of this clash of Jewish and non-Jewish cultures. I'm done, but I will take questions. Please, yeah. Right. So again, it plays out differently in Sephardic lands and in Ashkenazic lands. Post 1492, in Ashkenazic lands, you're now in Eastern Europe. As I mentioned before, the policy becomes much, I don't mean more harsh, it becomes much more formal because of the difference in Christian society. The issue of how to deal with Meranos, you have all kinds of tshuvas there, and that becomes almost a subspecialty. You know, that becomes, that's what Bibi Netanyahu's father wrote about, the index of those tshuvas, and you have to be very careful there, because he argued that very quickly the Rabbanim became disenamored of the Meranos, except there's a halachic issue there too. There you have an issue of Meranos living, again, that's their term, new Christians, however you want to call them, crypto-Jews, all there's a range there, living beside the Jewish community for a period of decades. That's different than a Jew who goes out and wants to come back in. So how you handle that kind of staid, ongoing phenomenon, if you follow me, may be different than how you handle people going out and trying to come back in. But you're right, there's a lot of policy there that has to be talked about. Take one, then two. Yeah. Right. Well, so you do have, you're quite correct, you do have cases where apostates become, Jewish apostates, the worst enemies of the Jews. But even though there are a few on the scene this early, they're not the policy setters. In other words, Peter the Venerable wasn't urged on here by Mishumadim per se. He developed this from Rupert. They had a whole discussion. So I think in terms of the original onset here, then you come to trial. The Talmud, obviously, Nicholas Donen and others, but I think the Mishumadim are not as much policy makers as policy carrier outers, not a word, yeah.
So, in terms of like social
Right.
They would have had the action to those.
100%. 100%. And the 13th century is a century of Christian piety, and the Jewish devil comes up too. But that's happening just after some of this. In other words, the genesis of this is before. So to be sure, it has to be figured in, but it doesn't tell the whole story. But correct. Yes, sir.
I'm just curious. That case of the Jewish woman who intermarried.
Right.
That
Very good question. The lashon is very, the language is very interesting. Nitma'a bein hagoyim with an ayin. She's submerged. So I don't think it presumes anything necessarily about her formal Christian status, but just she had children with this non-Jewish man, and she lived comfortably, and you know, I don't mean comfortably well, but she lived normally amongst Christians. And that's enough for this sort of tumas akum factor or feature to kick in. So I
agree
with you, and I cautioned at the outset, don't try any of this at home, right? And that's not a duck. To handle the modern questions, you've got to look at those societies. I will tell you, for those of you who've been very patient to the very end, the fact is there's one other place where this thing becomes unbelievable at the same time. Rashi was so, and if I said this earlier, people might have gotten more upset, but Rashi was so convinced of this principle and so consistent of Av Pishachot Yisrael Hu, that Rashi held that, let's say in a case of a man who dies and he and his wife were childless, and there's a brother-in-law, his brother is available, but he's a Meshumad, Rashi said that nonetheless, you've got to get him to do Chalitza. You'll say the chances of this Christian now doing chalitza, forget if he wants to, the church, are slim to none, and Rashi is sticking the poor aguna wife, where he's making her into an aguna, and Rashi certainly wouldn't want that. And the answer is, it's not that he doesn't have rachmanis on the aguna, but he has his principle of Af Pi Shechati Yisrael, a Jew is a Jew is a Jew. This brother may be a meshumid, but he's Jewish, and to oraisa he must do chalitza. There is a group of German Balei HaTosfos in the late 12th and early 13th centuries, right at this time, one in print, two in manuscript, who hold, at least tentatively, that it's not necessary for that brother, the Meshumid, to perform Chalitza, because again, for this approach, things are starting to move. So I will tell you that what we've done today is sort of the tip of the iceberg, and I thank you for being very patient, even though we started late. I appreciate it. I wish you Freilich and Chanukah, and everything should be well. Thank you. Thank you, folks. I'm happy to take questions at the podium if you like.